Welcome to this Leeds Law School podcast. My name is Louisa Ashley, and I'm joined today by Jill Dickinson and Terry Lisa Griffiths. And we're going to be speaking about pracademia. We'll find out a little bit more about what that means. But first of all, Jill, can you just introduce yourself and tell me a little bit about your background?
Yes, of course. Thank you, Louisa. I'm a reader of law at Leeds Law School. And before moving into academia, I was a lawyer for 10 years and particularly enjoyed working with work placement students and trainee solicitors and supporting them with their career development. And essentially that led to my move into higher education, and I've not looked back since.
Fantastic. Thank you, Jill. And Terry Lisa, tell us how you've ended up in this pracademia space.
Hi, so my name's Terry Lisa Griffiths, and I'm a senior lecturer in criminology at Sheffield Hallam University. And my career background is actually as a careers advisor. And I was recruited into an academic role to support them with developing the employability content of their courses. So I've obviously always had an interest in career paths and career development. And I identified as a pracademic. And it was something that Jill and I were interested in terms of how our previous practice experience influenced our teaching and research practice.
So you've both had quite different journeys into this space, and I believe that you have recently had a book published on this very subject of pracademia. So congratulations on that. So what is pracademia?
I can take that if you like. So essentially, a pracademic, in our view, is someone who's got experience of working in both practice and academia. So these might be people who hold dual roles as both practitioners and academics, or they might be people like ourselves who have made a complete career transition from practice into academia. Don't know if you want to add to that, Terry Lisa.
I think, as Jill said, there are people who have different kinds of roles, so they might still be in practice whilst teaching in academia, or they might have made the full transition. So they do have very varied career experiences in terms of the path that they've taken. But what our research revealed was that they actually have experiences in common, which we believe makes them quite a distinct group within the kind of more wider group of academics.
It's interesting, isn't it? Listening to what you're saying, it sounds like this is a bit of a challenge to the perception of the academic ivory tower persona. Yeah. So with that in mind, to what extent do you both individually identify with or find yourself using this term pracademic, and why?
Yeah, I can take that. I think that in terms of me personally, early on in my career, I identified more with the term because I found that my practice as an academic was heavily influenced by my previous professional background. But naturally, as I have moved through my career and I've been in an academic role for over 10 years now and have sort of made the expected career developments around getting involved with different types of teaching and, of course, forging a research path, I would more closely identify with less of a kind of a pracademic term now, but more as a kind of an academic who has professional experience, or sometimes referred to as a second career academic.
Interesting. And Jill, would you agree with Terry Lisa? Do you have a similar relationship with the concept and the term, or is yours slightly different?
I'm really happy to use the term pracademic to describe the career path that I've taken. So I spent 10 years as a lawyer working in private practice, And then I've spent 10 plus years in academia, so both really significant chunks of time. And I think the extent to which I draw on my practice for the academic role, so in terms of like guest speakers and collaboration, research and that kind of thing, I think for me, the term pracademic suits me quite well.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, though, it's not a universally celebrated idea, is it? Would I be right in saying that?
You would, yeah. And actually, I think there are two sort of aspects to this. So I think it would be good to draw on some of the contributors to the edited collection that Jill and I had published at the end of last year, 2023, because they actually used varied terms to describe themselves as well. And that related to a number of different factors. So for instance, Campbell et al. Talk about pracademics as those who have influence across both practice and academic-based places and spaces. So things like research collaborations between higher education and industry, maintaining and continuing to develop networks with practitioners, inviting guest speakers to speak to students. And others talked about being in academic spaces that were strongly focused on practice. So, for instance, we had a chapter from Wilkinson and Wilkinson, who coined the phrase non-pracademics to describe themselves as more kind of traditional path academics who were working in a very highly practice-based discipline, specifically related to kind of child development. Jill, do you want to take this?
I think you've covered that really nicely. So theirs was a joint autoethnographic account, and very much they were talking about how non-pracademics can equally feel things like imposter syndrome as well as pracademics can. So it gave a really interesting insight to the collection.
So by developing and deploying the concept of pracademic and non-pracademic, it's a way of acknowledging and providing some credibility where maybe sometimes that credibility may not be lacking, but be perceived in certain aspects of the academic community as lacking. And I think it's fascinating what you're talking about, particularly at a time when so much of what we do in higher education is going beyond the joy of learning for learning's sake and is very much focused on career prospects and employability and bringing in those sort of practice-based elements and knowledge and expertise is of absolute fundamental value to our students, which is who we're here for at the end of the day. And I suppose that takes me on to my next question, really, thinking about the particular benefits that pracademics bring to higher education. Jill, do you want to have a little conversation and expand on that a little bit? Enlighten me.
Absolutely. I mean, it might be good to maybe take one of the chapters as an example. So one of the contributors, Cadet, talks about within the context of criminology, she brought in some criminal justice practitioners, and they were involved in co-designing and developing an undergraduate simulation module. And she talks about the multiple benefits for the practitioners, the students, and also the organisation. So these sorts of experiences where you're getting externals to come in, it really helps to develop students' understanding of, you know, real world issues within the criminal justice system. It also encouraged students to think of different career options that they might not have previously considered. And also she talks about it giving them an advantage potentially in the, you know, recruitment market as well. So, yeah, really, really good example, I think, of that. Teresa, have you got anything you want to add to that?
So one of the key benefits that has actually threaded through a lot of the research that we've done on this topic, not just in the edited collection, is around the idea of values. So Louisa, you talked earlier about kind of pracademics having this perception that they are supporting students with their sort of job market prospects and their career development. And one of the facets of that is that we found in our in a research study that we published in Studies in Higher Education in 2020, that pracademics actually had quite strongly held values that they carried with them from practice. And they were really keen to ensure that they had these values at the forefront of a lot of what they were teaching their students. I'm going to draw an example of a participant in that study because I think it illustrates this point really nicely. This was a participant who taught architecture students, and they discussed the importance of accessibility within architecture and ensuring that the images that they were using in their teaching were representative of different types of groups of people and different users of buildings, and ensuring that in everything that they did, their students were considering the different ways that buildings could be used and the diverse range of people that could be occupying them. And I think that speaks really nicely to some of the ideas that pracademics talk about. And this is also in a number of chapters. So Madhum and Bradley talk about teaching values, in their case, autonomy with law students. And it's this idea of encouraging the sort of next generation of professionals, if you like, to critique current practice and think about the ways that it could be improved for the benefit of future generations.
That's really interesting, isn't it? And I suppose that transition for those colleagues who have been predominantly practice-based into academia, and giving them the space and opportunity to both identify and reflect upon the values that they will be bringing into the teaching space with them. So that it is a big transition. I myself am a solicitor, and I've gone through that transition of moving from legal practice into academia. What particular challenges do you think pracademics face when they make that journey?
So again, I'm going to draw on some of the contributors in our edited collection, because they did encapsulate quite a lot of the challenges quite nicely. So for instance, there was environmental challenges. So both Taylor and Hodgson referred to the challenge of becoming accustomed to the HE environment and the tacit practices that were happening within that. Now, some people may say, well, career academics also face those challenges, but what's slightly different for pracademics is that career academics will have that kind of training, if you like, as they are undertaking their doctorate, and they might be working as a teaching assistant, and they have that background of understanding some of the tacit practices in higher education. But pracademics occupy quite a unique position in that they are recruited because of their expertise in a particular practitioner space, and then they move into the higher education space and they become new again. So Hodgson talks about that feeling of going from expert to novice, and how it's quite a unique feeling that makes the experience of pracademics quite distinct, and that can then throw up feelings around imposter syndrome and a perceived gap between, as I say, the reason why pracademics are recruited because of their practitioner expertise, and then the value of that knowledge when they move into the higher education setting.
And I think we'd all agree that the first year or so in teaching is quite literally a roller coaster ride with a lot to take on board there. So I think it's really helpful having the conceptualizations that are shared within your edited collection to help understand and make sense of that journey and those experiences. So I'm wondering how universities could maybe better value or support the contribution that pracademics make to the community, whether they could better champion that contribution. We've also, you talked about environment, but also there may be additional accreditation that is required on the part of practitioners as they enter academia, and that combined with this new environment and the very different approach to the working day when you're teaching, what should we be doing differently? Jill?
Thank you. So, yeah, I think I completely agree. I think there are a number of challenges that pracademics do face. I remember myself, you know, moving from practicing to academia, you've got to get professional recognition, you need to get a teaching qualification, you know, you're getting used to the language and culture of academia, so that there's quite a lot there, and it can be difficult. So just drawing on some of the examples from the collection and as to how universities could value and champion what pracademics do. So one of the contributors, Obembi, talks about the development of enterprise career pathways. So rather than kind of having separate teaching and learning and research career development pathways, Obembi talks about these new pathways that are coming through where people are recognised and valued for their collaboration and their impact and how they're engaging with industry. So I think that's a really nice example. And then also she talks about buddy systems, and certainly I can really relate to that. I've worked with some really great colleagues as both buddies and mentors, and I think it's brilliant to work with somebody who's kind of taken the career path that you'd aspire to. I think that can be really motivating and supportive. So I don't know if you want to add anything, Terry-Lisa.
I think some, as you mentioned, informal and also formalised systems as well for recognising pracademic experience would be very, very helpful. So supporting pracademics to obtain a PhD if they want to, and also ensuring that pracademic career journeys are acknowledged. I think it's okay for me to draw on an example at my own institution, Sheffield Hallam University, because it's something that Jill and I actually sort of consulted with the team on when they were developing the academic careers framework. And Sheffield Hallam have a practitioner pathway on their academic careers framework. So that is an example of a formalized acknowledgement of the experience, knowledge that practitioner academics can bring with them, and also a pathway to support them with developing that knowledge and expertise further, but within the kind of academic role framework.
Yeah, I think that sounds like it's a sensible step in terms of supporting staff retention as well as career progression. I know here at Leeds Beckett, we have a knowledge and enterprise career pathway that complements the research side of things and also education. So within your own contribution to the edited collection, you talk about the way that artifacts or objects can be used. And I'd be fascinated to know a little bit more about where this came from, and also if you had to select your own objects, I'm sure you've probably done this before, that represents your individual professional journeys, what objects would you be selecting and what would the reasons for that be? Terry-Lisa, I'll come to you first on that, if that's okay.
Sure, yeah. So starting with why we thought this would be an interesting or useful exercise was a connection with an ex-colleague, Mark Dole, who undertook a project around objects in social work. So he invited social workers to submit an object or an item which they felt represented something or some aspect of their career. And he found that the utilization of objects helped to tell a story of social work, and the idea that there was some sort of collective practice, set of professional values that were illustrated through these objects. And it's not just Dole, but there are other researchers who have utilized artifacts to think about the relationship of objects to career journeys. The idea that objects can be brought to life through human narrative to trigger memories and reflection, and also to encourage storytelling. So an example that possibly everybody can connect with and perhaps understand it in some way is Lunden and Nulden, who conducted a study with novice police officers around the objects and tools and items that they utilize within their work as well. The idea of kind of notebooks, or different sort of objects, their uniform, and how these items supported them with developing their professional knowledge of what was required of them in their role as well. We do have some examples of artifacts from the chapter, and I think Jill's going to share those for us.
That's great. Thanks, Terry-Lisa. Some of the examples that we included then, we talked about tools, and there was one particular example where there was an academic who was based in journalism, and they were talking about how they brought their ears from practice. So they found that the listening skills that they developed in practice really helped them with their sort of academic advisor pastoral role. Other examples of totems or trophies that perhaps hold symbolic meaning for the individual. One of the best ones I think that always springs to mind is a colleague had brought with them a star charm. So they'd been bought this as a present by their former colleagues from practice when they made the move into academia, and they were telling us about how they were walking into this big lecture theatre for the first time with hundreds of students, and it was just a really good reminder for them that they are an expert in their field, and it gave them that confidence. So I think that's a really nice example as well.
So are we going to find out what your individual objects and artifacts are?
Of course. Mine is an example of something that is symbolic rather than has any practical use. It's actually a photograph. And it was given to me when I left my last job in the community before moving into university, and it's a picture of my colleagues and me, all of us together, after completing a charity run. And it just reminds me of the transition to academia, because it felt quite lonely comparatively. Sometimes I think that academia can be quite an isolating job, for various reasons, because of different schedules and the way that we work, and obviously the fact that people have their individual kind of research interests that they're also pursuing as well. And I remember struggling with the transition because I am someone who really enjoys teamwork and collaboration. And essentially, it just reminds me that I have made my own pathway within academia. Collaboration is still something that I value, and it's something that I've always kind of sought out within my career. And I've been able to make those connections in with colleagues in different ways, not necessarily people within my department, but also kind of people who share my interests both within my wider university community and the wider sector as well. And I think that this edited collection is a really nice representative of how or what happens when you work together with colleagues in lots of different institutions who share the same interests as you. So that's mine.
That's lovely, really lovely. Thank you, Terry Lisa. Jill, what about yours?
I think I've probably got quite a collection of artifacts that remind me from my time in practice, maybe because I spent quite a long time there. But a particular one is my briefcase. So this was given to me as a present when I qualified as a solicitor. And I remember, you know, when I did work placements, I always remember solicitors having a briefcase. So, you know, they were taking them to court, taking them into client meetings. And I've still got mine, and it's collecting dust in the back of the wardrobe. But I can't, yeah, I haven't got around to parting with it yet. I probably never use it again, but it's a really nice reminder for me of my time in practice and what I can then bring into academia from there.
I think that's so interesting, isn't it? You know, I have a background in theatre, and I very much value the confidence that we get from the costume that we wear and the props that we use and carry. And you've reminded me, Jill, when I went for my trainee solicitor training contract interview, I took a kind of a briefcase type bag with me. It had literally nothing in it. I mean, a piece of paper. I didn't need it, but I just felt like I did need it. That was my crutch for that. So that's really interesting. Thank you for sharing those with me. So before we close, can you just remind us of the title of your collection, please?
Yes, of course. So it's Professional Development for Practitioners in Academia, or Pracademia.
Lovely. And anything else that either of you would like to add? I mean, it's been delightful finding out more about the term Pracademia and the concept, and speaking to you both as arguably pracademics, and reflecting on my own position as well. But yeah, is there anything we've not touched upon that you'd want to share with listeners before we say our farewells?
I think for me, one of the key messages of the book is how you can have groups of pracademics and groups of people who have taken perhaps more traditional academic career paths. And very much we're all about recognising and valuing the different skills and experiences that each group are bringing to this, so that, you know, we can pull together those resources and draw on them for the benefit of everybody. So I think that would be the only thing I would add.
Thanks, Jill. Terry Lisa, was there anything you wanted to say?
Yeah, I think that's a nice way to finish. I think we already have briefly, but I think it's good to acknowledge that there are still ongoing debates around this term. It's not universally loved, as you sort of alluded to earlier, Louisa, and that's absolutely fine. I think that it's great to have these conversations, but hopefully through this podcast and through the edited collection, we've demonstrated, as I mentioned at the beginning, that there are a distinct group of academics who have shared experiences. And it's not about encouraging divisions between academics. It's more about supporting the transition for this distinct group. And as Jill has said, thinking about ways that we can bring all of our strengths together for the benefit of the wider sector.
Thank you. So you've all now been well schooled in the idea of Pracademia. So thank you for listening and being with us today. As I say, my name is Louisa Ashley, and I was joined by Jill Dickinson and by Terry Lisa Griffiths. Thank you and goodbye. Thank you to you both.